So what do you want to talk about now? Because everyone wants you to come back. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I am your perfectly capable host of this exciting New View Safety Differently Family 2 podcast. Thanks for listening. It is always good to hang on with you. Hey, it is truly going to be the end of September. It's happening. Fall is here. We've just had Santa Fe Fiestas. That's kind of like our little city party that we have, and that's really fun. We burn Zozobra. I can't even say it. Zozobra. And if you want to know more about that, Google it, because it is really interesting and hedonistic. I know that's a big word, but nonetheless, you're worth it. You're worth the big words. And today, well, today I'm getting ready to go on some travel next week, which is what I do often, packing the little bag and getting ready to have all sorts of fun. It's going to be a great time, and I'm going to have a great time because I get to work with lots of really groovy people like you. Before we go much further, I wanted to take a moment and tell you about a website that I don't know if you know about called safetydifferently.com. That's it, safetydifferently.com. Amazing website. Open discussions, theoretic discussions, artistic discussions, opinions. A place to go if you're thinking and writing and blogging, if you will, about sort of the new view of safety. It's phenomenal, and you're going to like it a bunch. If you've not been there, take a moment, bounce in, put your email in, and join. It doesn't cost anything. I mean, it's just you'll just be kind of on the list when a new post comes out. I've really enjoyed reading it. It's all the normal cast of characters that are writing on it, but they're writing in a more free, I know it's a discursive sort of environment. They can talk about almost anything, and they do. They talk about a bunch of stuff, and it's really, really cool. So if you get a chance to go there, please do so. That would be great. Lots of fun. Today's a big day. You might can tell from the beginning of the podcast that we're going to talk to our friend Martha Acosta. She's, you know her credentials. If not, she explains them pretty much through the podcast. This is a great podcast. Holy buckets. This podcast focuses entirely upon safety leadership. Well, really, if you push me, it focuses entirely on leadership, but we're going to talk specifically about safety leadership. And she says some things about safety culture that I think are pretty spot on and quite different than what, other folks are saying. I mean, it's a world full of opinions, and part of the reason we listen to the pre-accident podcast is to listen to new ideas. So this is a different idea. I just think this one aligns really well. In fact, she uses a phrase throughout this podcast. I'll repeat it back to her a couple times, where the fact that safety culture just sort of shows up. And I think that's a really powerful way to understand safety culture. Martha is amazing, and she's amazing because she's a good thinker and a good designer and a good maker of models. And she really has thought long and hard about the issues that you deal with every single day. And her point is that leaders really have four distinct areas that they actually can manage. Four areas where they have influence and control. And they're not the same four areas you think they are. And that's why I think you're really going to like Martha's podcast. So let me not spend a whole bunch more time yammering on with my yammerness, other than to tell you life is grand and all is well. If you get a chance to give me feedback, or you have ideas for podcasts, or you have a safety moment you want to share, all those things are wide open. I'm more than welcome to having them. I love to hear from you. But more importantly, I want you to be involved in this at any level you feel comfortable with, because without you, I'm just sitting around talking in a microphone, sitting on the couch, which isn't bad. I mean, it definitely kills time, but quite honestly, I think it could even be better. Until then, listen to Martha's podcast. I'll come back afterwards and sort of wrap it up and talk to you a little bit more. But enjoy this one, because it's really, really good.
Well, I thought it was really interesting that people are interested in this pain metaphor.
Yeah, totally.
And how that helps us identify where we have pain points, problems that need to be solved.
Don't you think the reason they're interested in that metaphor is because it's a easily attainable way to talk about sort of system conflicts or mm-hmm. weaknesses or latent organizational weaknesses or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, because it's a place where a lot of these different issues may converge.
Right.
You know, the human aspect is interfacing with the systems aspect and something isn't going right.
Oh, that's totally right. I mean, that's mm-hmm. exactly what it is. And there's tons of these in every organization, right? I mean, there's lots of places.
Mm-hmm.
Management often doesn't know of them.
And why does management know of them? One of the things I think that I've thought about, which is really simple, is so Todd, how do you feel about managers saying to their employees, come to me with solutions, not problems?
Yeah, so the three things, what's wrong, mm-hmm. what do I need to know, and how do I fix it on one page? It's crap. It's crap because it tells the worker that the manager doesn't have time to do the learning and analysis. The manager only is in charge of the fix. The great distance, whether actual or metaphoric, between managers and workers mm-hmm. is really a problem.
It's a huge
but there's problem. A great distance between the ankle and the brain. So how do we handle that? I mean, that's something to think about, right?
Well, I mean, I think it's a matter of how do you, well, I just came from yoga, right? How do I get my ankle and my brain and my little toes, you know, trying to get my little toe to move away from my big toe to do these balance poses has taken years. But it really is a concerted effort, and that effort means coming into the present, the now together. So when a manager says to their employees, and it sounds like a really smart thing, and I'm sure that, you know, smart people have said this, have told managers to do this, don't come to me with solutions and not problems. It seems like a really great empowerment move. But really, what you're doing is you're creating that distance that you were talking about. So I one of my clients is General Motors, and one of the senior leaders that I was working with, we were having a little chat before a session, and he said, I got rid of all of my status meetings. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Why? He's like, what? I found myself in these meetings all the time where people were just telling me how far they were to their goals, what status they'd done, what they'd done.
Oh, my God. You mean they got rid of the stoplight chart? The red, green, yellow chart? Oh, no.
Well, so many of our management systems are built around that, you know, our balanced scorecard, all of that sort of thing.
Dashboards. People talk about dashboards all the time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we'll put it on our dashboard. Because metrics we care about are metrics we do.
Right. And, you know, and that's okay. But do you really need to have a meeting to pull people in to give you status? Does someone really need to come to you with the solution, or can they just go with the solution? Isn't that more empowering?
Absolutely.
And so what he turned his meetings into were people coming in with the things that were bugging them, coming in with the things that they couldn't figure out. They were coming in to the brain trust, which was the team, to get together and talk about, probably not like this, but talk about their feelings, talk about their pain, and get everybody there to sort of pull it apart and think about it and look at it from another perspective. And just like you always talked about with your learning teams, not to move to the solution right away.
Right.
But to actually noodle on it.
Live with the pain for a while.
Live with the pain for a while, and then use the team as a way of actually learning and solving the problem. And this whole needing to always show up to your work as the hero starts going away. And that, I think, that sort of ego-driven position within our cultures is what creates cultures that aren't conducive to safety.
But this is relatively modern thinking. This is pretty controversial, because what you're saying is that the senior leadership team meeting isn't a status meeting. The senior leadership meeting is really a problem identification meeting, where we talk mm-hmm. about problems, and with that group of people, we actually create a set of questions to understand the problem, which then allows us to go out and discover the problem.
Mm-hmm.
do the analysis and then create the solution at the pointy end of the stick.
Mm-hmm.
God, that's brilliant.
Well,
I never thought about it that way, because we do it exactly.
Yeah.
The solution always comes from the solution comes from leadership or regulator or customer.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is at the pointy end of the stick. I like this.
Well, it's not very different from what you've been talking about. I think, though, one of the pieces that we need to think about, and this is from another conversation. So I was hiking with a friend of mine who used to work at Sandia, and he, in the 90s, was part of these tiger teams.
Remember the tiger teams?
So, you know, he was talking a lot about safety culture and saying how the tiger teams were creating a safety culture within the lab system. And I said, well, were they? I mean, I believe 100% that those of you on the tiger teams were modeling the kind of behavior that you wanted to see throughout the organization. And I believe that those of you in the tiger teams had a safety culture. But why hasn't that culture permeated into now?
So that's a good question. We should probably say a tiger team is like a really advanced deep dive audit where mm-hmm. you bring people from outside. And they spend quite a bit of time, and they cost quite a bit of money, to do a really aggressive peer assist. Aggressive is the wrong word. A really deep, a profound.
But I don't think that. I think that some of these tiger teams, certainly the one that Shannon was on, was consisted of internal people, but they were from the outside of that particular project
right.
or program.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah. So they were still internal, and that's why. Well, they were external and internal, and I think the internal piece was the part where he was thinking, we need to change the culture.
When you say safety culture, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, let's go back to when I mean culture, what do I mean?
Okay, let's go all the way back.
Right, because Edgar Schein, our friend.
We love Edgar Schein, yeah.
Right, said that when significant change, I don't know if I'm saying this right, you can correct me, Todd. When significant change comes up against significant culture, culture always wins.
Perfect.
And he was not a big proponent of the fact that we could change culture, right?
Right.
So, and I agree with that. I don't think that we can change culture from the outside, and we can't change culture directly. Culture is something that arises from behavior. And it's that behavior, the conditioning that we have when we interact with our environment, that tells us what matters, how we do things around here, what works, what doesn't work, and all of that becomes internalized. And that internalization on a group level becomes culture. And that consistency within how you've internalized it and I've internalized it, that's what shows up as culture. Someone from the outside sees culture. We, on the inside, it's very hard for us to see culture. So if I'm teaching a cultural intelligence class, the first part of it is just trying to get us to see our own culture, which is really hard. We need that external lens. And that's what creates the problem where we think that because we see culture externally, we can change culture externally. And that's the huge fallacy that I think Edgar Schein was pointing to.
Yeah, I agree.
But the actual components of culture, I don't think are that hard to influence if you're a good leader.
Tell me more.
And this comes down to good leadership.
Yeah.
Well, so what do leaders have control over? They get to shape people's roles, right? They
right.
get to say, you do this, and this person does this, and
right.
this is the power dynamic between you, and this is how we fit on the hierarchy. So these are all of your roles. That's all the identity piece. Identity is a key part of culture, how
Agreed.
We identify to the overall culture and the overall group. The other thing that managers, leaders have are they have some control over processes, right?
Yeah.
They have a lot of control over processes.
Well, I like to think they own the process.
They own the process.
They're processes.
Right. So they get to say how we're doing work. And the processes that they own, they don't have to come up with them themselves, but the processes that they own is what tells people how we do work around here. right?
Right. Fair enough.
Those processes, I mean, even if we think about culture as these sets of values, and the way that a lot of organizations think they're going to change cultures from the top down, from the outside in, is by driving these values. But the values ultimately drive up from the behavior, I think.
I agree.
So in the processes tell people a lot about what the organization values. How you do work tells you what matters.
Gotcha.
Right?
Yeah, that's really important.
Yeah. And then, okay, so processes. What other things? Can you think of anything else?
That a leader leads?
Yeah, that a leader leads, that they have control over, that's going to
shape incentive.
Them.
I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
That'd be the only really the third thing I could think of.
Well, incentive's definitely key. It's the measurement piece, right?
Okay.
That what we measure is what we do. So that's not untrue, I don't think. I think that people recognize that. But what we measure, what we incentivize, what we punish, that tells people what matters, what my limits are, how we do things around here, all of those pieces that are big parts of culture. And then the other one I think that managers really do have control over is norms and expectations about how we interact with each other.
Ah.
Yeah.
So really the social norms, the bullying, anti-bullying, kindness, anti-kindness.
Right. We collaborate to do work together, or we don't collaborate. We're all, you know, individuals, and then we take our individual work and we put it together, or we collaborate as we work together. We deal with conflict this way. We're going to be conflict averse. And therefore,
right.
Probably not get down to, if we're conflict averse, then creativity and learning isn't as important.
Right.
But if we're conflict seeking and we know how to create, use conflict in a constructive way, then we are an innovative organization and we care about learning.
So counter that notion of managers set the standard for the norms with the word discipline. Or the word accountability. They're very different. I don't want to sort of convolute discipline and accountability. But is that what you're saying? Is that discipline's a part of that norm setting?
Discipline, I think, fits more into the measurement side of things.
Oh, okay.
Because it's what we punish and what we reward ultimately comes down to the things that we measure. I think there, but accountability, I think, is a really important part of the interaction norms that managers set. So I like to use the definition of accountability that goes back to what accountability means, which is speaking up.
Right.
And so when I'm accountable, that means that I need to speak up when there is something that I am accountable to, that I'm responsible for, that I have my fingers in, that I ultimately need to do, that I speak up. When there's a problem, I speak up. When there is a change, I speak up and I get help, or, you know, I do something that from that speaking up that allows me to take control of the situation.
But to have an environment where I can speak up, I need to work in an organization where the leaders have created a conflict accepting norm.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? They can't be sort of
right, and that's
afraid
when,
of conflict.
And that's when accountability becomes perverted into blame. When
right.
you can't speak, because I think accountability also needs to be shared, right? We talked about
before.
Accountability needs to be shared. And so if you and I are working together, you need to be empowered to speak up for me, because sometimes I'm operating in an unconscious space.
Sure, 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 sure.
And so you need to be able to say, you know, hey, you might not see this, but this is what's going on. This is what you're doing. This is the consequences of your actions.
So this is a pretty bold, you're making a pretty bold statement that what leaders think they manage, which is production, et cetera, you know, output, whatever output is not really true. Mm-hmm. Leaders don't manage output. Workers create output. Leaders mm-hmm. manage sort of the big four you just talked about, right?
Yeah, leaders are managing. You have to, as a leader, you need, and if you want to create a safe work environment, you need to get down to the behaviors and how you drive those behaviors. And those behaviors are how you control behavior are roles and processes and norms or expectations and measurement.
And so what's crazy is that behavior is a really behavior, worker behavior is not a function of choice. It's a function of roles, processes, mm-hmm. norms, and incentive.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there can definitely be choice in there. That's probably part of the empowerment piece. But the manager has some control over that. And outcomes, you know, outcomes-based focus is all well and good. It can be really helpful, especially in trying to pull together a diverse team where you want different people to look at the problem from a different point of view so that you can get a robust problem-solving conversation going. And in order to keep people from getting into destructive conflict, you know, anger, that sort of thing, you get people to share their expectations about the outcome, recognize that they have a shared outcome that they're going to, a shared purpose that they're moving towards, and that there are lots of different paths to that outcome. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm fixated on the fact that the leadership culture, the leadership should drive an organization that's conflict accepting. Mm-hmm. That wants to talk about problems, makes it easy mm-hmm. to talk about problems, because by talking about problems, we develop a good question, and then that question goes out to be answered in the field.
Yeah.
That's remarkable.
Well, I think that, I mean, and don't you realize, I mean, that's the foundation of creativity. That's the foundation of innovation. That's the foundation of creating a learning organization. And isn't that everything the safety organization needs to be? Because you need to be able to improvise when conditions change.
I mean, that's exactly right. And it's improvisation. It's strategic improvisation. So let me ask the million-dollar question. Mm. How does fear play into this? Because it's got to be, I mean, that's sort of the underlying current underneath all of this. If I'm a scaredy cat as a leader, right, if I want to collectively neglect problems that are too wicked to handle,
yeah,
that's a function of fear.
Right. Well, let's make a distinction.
Please do.
Between fear and anxiety.
Okay.
So I just read this article. So I can't remember the name of the guy. The guy who popularized the amygdala. He's a neuroscientist who did some work on the amygdala. And from there, you know, Daniel Goleman picked that up and talked about how the amygdala was the emotional center and all of this stuff. And he put out a paper, as most people who come up with big ideas that influence the world, you always have to put out a paper saying, yeah, that's what I said, but you didn't quite understand it. And it's much more complex than that, right? So I was reading that, and the way that he was trying to explain the complexity of how people may have misconstrued his research was making a distinction between fear and anxiety. Now, fear is a biological process that keeps us alive, right?
Got you.
We're a band of early humans. We're walking through the savanna in the tall grass. And this is back when lions were further up on the food chain than us.
Right.
So the lions like to hide in tall grass. So there's a lion out there hiding. And somebody sees the lion and goes, and that fear's super contagious.
Right.
So that fear runs through everyone and they run away. Right?
Gotcha.
And once they're away from the lion, that fear goes away. But what does fear give us? It gives us, you know, high cortisol levels, our heart beats faster. It takes our sympathetic nervous system takes over and it just makes us able to fight or flee. That's a great mechanism. That's why we are alive today and we have these big brains and, you know, this is why we're alive. And it's a key part of our evolution. But when the danger is gone, the fear should go. But what human beings have managed to do to complicate our lives is turn fear into anxiety.
Ah.
And anxiety is that thinking that the lion is over there, you know, being traumatized by that relation, that situation with the lion, going back into the past and pulling out that fear, or going into the future and projecting that fear. And fear is something that's in the now, and it's fabulous, and it will keep you alive.
Gotcha.
Thank, you know, all the gods for fear.
Gotcha.
Anxiety is what creates this phenomenon that you are talking about. The managers that feel like they have to have zero risk in all of their operations and therefore shut down their operations so that there's no work happening, and that tension, that conflict between doing work and being safe shows up as this paradox that is unresolvable.
So there's really no such thing as fear of the unknown. It's anxiety of the unknown.
Yeah. I just want to, you know, take that word anxiety, because that helps us recognize that anxiety is something that we're creating for ourselves. The stories that we're telling about the future and the stories that we're telling about the past,
right?
They're the ones that are creating the ongoing anxiety and making us sick. You know, filling us with cortisol and giving us heart disease because our heart's working too hard, making us stupid. There's great studies that show that if you give somebody a cognitive test when they're in a state of heightened anxiety, their results are going to drop tremendously.
So how do we manage for anxiety? Because asking people to no longer feel anxious, it doesn't strike me as terribly effective.
Okay, so...
So I like this past future.
Right.
I mean, right?
So that it's the story.
So tell me
so
more.
The story of the fear, the story of the fear in the past, the story of the fear in the future, it's that story, it's that narrative that runs through our consciousness and tells us, oh, crap, I'm going to mess up. Oh, no, that happened to me in the past, and it's going to happen to me again. I'm never going to get over the mistake that I made back then, and no one's ever going to trust me again, right? So cognitive behavioral psychologists call this limited thinking patterns.
Right.
Basically, they're just self-defeating stories.
Yeah, and you play them over and over and over again.
You play them over and over and over again.
And in an organization, they telegraph out,
mm-hmm.
right? So if leadership has high anxiety, then that manifests itself in workers having high anxiety. In fact, workers may actually be seeing fear.
Yeah.
It may be quite immediate for them.
Right. And this is how it gets into the culture. Because, as you know, cultures, I mean, if you go to the way that anthropologists look at culture, social anthropologists look at culture, they see it as a bunch of intertwining narratives.
Right.
So you put an anxiety narrative into your culture, and that starts to color everything.
So then do you change the narrative in your organization so that it's always present tense? I mean, operationally? I mean, what do you do?
Well, so one, you have to go out and seek out these narratives, and then you have to address them. And one of the ways that you address them is by questioning them. So the thing is that these narratives don't actually make sense.
Yeah, I agree.
So, they're operating in our subconscious, right?
Yeah, I mean,
just like culture operates too. So operating in our subconscious. So if you get somebody to tell you the narrative, and you do this when you do investigations, you get those senior leaders to talk about why they did what they did. They hear the story and they realize it's the stupidest thing they've ever
heard. Yeah, I mean, that happens. And it's interesting because that would be the example I'd use is that, so I go out and I ask big companies, why do you do investigations?
Mm-hmm.
And I love how you use the word shows up. And this narrative shows up, like culture shows up. And the narrative is because we never want to have a repeat occurrence of this event. Well, that's just ridiculous because, first of all, you'll never have a repeat occurrence of that event. I mean, every event is very special.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a snowflake. It's context rich. Lots of crazy things happened probably pretty normal, crazy things, but they all happened. And the fact that that'll happen again is incredibly, I mean, it's impossible.
Right.
But that narrative shows up.
That narrative shows up. And even if it's, oh, we don't want this mistake to happen again, I would say, well, why? Because you know how to deal with this mistake now.
I see. That's brilliant.
Right? So that mistake, yeah, you want it to happen again. And this time you want it to happen without consequence.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Right. So really, when you start pulling out the narratives, then we can apply the light of reason to them and bring it down to the now. And the now, taking it back to those elements of how you shape culture, the now is our roles, our processes, our norms, our expectations, and what we measure and how we measure it. So. Then you look at that narrative and you address it with those tools that you have around the way that you manage behavior right now. So, I think the key thing that comes out in investigations is let's bring these narratives to light and have them see the light of day and weigh them up against the evidence.
Gotcha.
And weigh them up against the now. And the now is where you have control. Yes, right now I can reshuffle. We can change our roles a bit, you know, and we can discuss our roles. And right now we can think about how we want to interact together so that we can support each other better to be more safe. Right?
Yeah. So can companies call you? Are you available? Because this conversation would be really powerful to a senior leader or a leadership group or a company owner that's really struggling. You know, let's say they had a fatality accident and they're trying to sort of restore their operations back to a place where they can actually perform their task. Can they contact you?
Yeah, I do. I do leadership development. That's what I do all day.
How do they contact you? What's the best way to
What's the best way to contact me? Why don't they?
Do you have a website?
No.
I'm sorry. I don't have one either. I'm not judging.
I'm too busy with the stuff that Harvard has me do and the stuff that Cisco has me do to be sort of on my own. And isn't that kind of scary to be out there sort of? But no, I work with Harvard. No, I.
Yeah, no. I get that. I totally get that.
I guess they can. Is there a way that they can contact you through the podcast? Is there a?
Yeah, they can contact me.
Okay. Well, we live just a few blocks away.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I'm fine with
that.
That's fine. Okay, so that's good. I mean, that's fine.
Right. And then, I have an email address. I can give the email address.
Okay. Do you want to?
Yeah.
Give it away.
Okay. It's Martha, M-A-R-T-H-A, at Martica, MARTICA.com.
Got it. That's easy as peasy. Well, this was great. Thank you.
Sure.
These are great. You're like a rock star on the podcast.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Leadership really impacts everything. So if I focus all of my attention and work on figuring out how to make leaders better, well, how is that not going to be related to safety?
I agree completely. Completely. Thank you for your time.
Sure.
Excellent work. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. If you say thank you three times, that gives a magical completion to any podcast. I should try that every single time. What do you think? Isn't that amazing? I mean, Martha is just a resource. It's so exciting to me to think that these kind of thinkers are thinking about these problems. And she's been thinking about it a long time. Martha is not new to this discovery at all. In fact, Martha catered Sidney Decker's birthday party, probably almost 10 years, a while ago. She's played with the guys for a long time, and she's definitely a leader in thinking, and just the way she develops models and her thoughtfulness around these topics it's just remarkable to me. You can see why she's a hot commodity and why she spends a lot of time out in the field with people doing this kind of work and talking to leaders about how they lead. It blows me away that what she talked about is as leaders create tighter and tighter control, the farther and farther away they are from the work, how difficult it becomes. And this notion of making a conflict accepting culture, a culture that values the problem more than the answer, man, I don't know if you're thinking like I'm thinking, but that kind of blows me away because that is exactly where improvement happens. In fact, that's the nut we're trying to crack. It's amazing. because we send a lot of signals that there is one right way to do work, when in reality, that can never be true. There are always going to be multiple correct ways to do work simultaneously. What's interesting is that one right way problem comes from not the desperate need to answer the question, but the failure to actually ask the question. And that, my friends, is why we get together once a week and have these conversations. Man, I hope you like this one. I loved it. I really did. I love this. I love having Martha over. And it's great to just talk to her and listen to what the world sort of has to unfold from the brain of Martha Acosta. Thanks for your time. As always, learn something new every day, and you can check that out for today. You did. Have some fun, for goodness sakes, and always be safe.